Brighter Media Group original.
Hey, you're listening to Your Day Brighter, the podcast, Real Reasons to Have Hope in This World. I'm Tracy Tiernan. And do you ever meet somebody, first time meeting them, you feel like, I want to be their friend. I feel like we could just like sit down and talk for hours. That's how I felt about this conversation and this very special lady, Helen Smallbone. She is my guest on the podcast this week, and I can't wait for you to meet her. Now, you might not know her name, but you know the fruit of her life, some of it anyway. Joel and Luke from For King and Country, they are her sons. Rebecca St. James is her daughter. She and her husband David, the mother of seven amazing kids. And they have an incredible story of just living out of faith in God, trusting God for everything. I read her book. It's called Behind the Lights, where she just tells the story of the adventure that she went on when she married her husband, David. And it was a very unconventional life that she signed up for. And this lady knows what it is to literally trust God for everything. And I think you're going to love this conversation. I just didn't want it to end. I just wanted to, you know, get a cup of tea. I don't even drink tea, okay? I drink coffee. That's how much Mrs. Smallbone just affected me. So grab a cup of whatever you love and cozy up, and let's glean some wisdom from this amazing lady, Helen Smallbone, on Your Day Brighter. I've been listening to your book on audio as well. And so your voice has been in my
ear. You poor lady.
You have been ministering to my soul. God's timing is always so perfect, isn't it?
It is.
I'm listening to you tell your story, and it's just exactly the things that I needed to be reminded of and the things that I need to hear in my life right now. And so thank you for sharing your story and your book. Congratulations on this, by the way.
Well, thank you. I believe actually today is the 1 year anniversary of its release, which is pretty crazy, eh? And even the fact that we're doing this interview at 1 year after the anniversary of it being out, it's been a very surreal journey, I must say. It's been pretty crazy.
You have such an incredible memory for details and specific experiences along the way. And in your book, you go into great detail about how you and your family came to be, you and David coming together, your growing up years. The detail is breathtaking, because I feel like I can see the movie. I feel like I know you. I'm like, how did she remember all of that? Are you a journaler? How did you?
I'm not. No, I the only journaling I've done is actually for my children. And that after Rebecca was born, she would have been, I don't know, maybe a year, maybe a bit more. You know how when your husband comes home from work and you've got little kids and you sort of want to catch him up on the things that happened that day, and you're like, oh, you know, this happened, and sometimes I would either not remember or I would never tell him, and they just seem precious moments. And so I wanted to then do a journal, I called it like a diary, of the standout events of the kids so that they would remember, because I didn't think I was ever going to remember. I started out really diligently, and then I would keep them beside my bed, and then at the end of the night, I might, if there was anything from any one of them, I would just pick out their little journal, and I would write in theirs. And my idea was to give it to them when they turned 21. As a memory of their childhood. And sometimes, I mean, life happens, more kids happen, and I would get slacker and slacker. And so then in the end, I thought, well, even if I only did a profile for, you know, each birthday, then they would at least have something to remind themselves of those precious years of when they're little. And I suppose these days, mums are photo journaling, but we didn't have that ability. So this was my attempt to be able to do that. And obviously the first kids have not too bad. But as I got down the line, the last couple were just pretty chaotic. And it was like, and so then I got to taking notes in a notebook, thinking, oh, that'll spur my memory. And then I can actually write it out, write it properly in their book. And so I found that years later, I'm looking at the notes, trying to make sense of them to put it. It was a bit of a chaos. Anyway, the heart was in the right place. But that's really the only journaling I've done. The incidents, I think, and I had one son who's actually our sort of videographer, director. He said after I wrote the book, he said, I'm intrigued with the stories that you included and the stories that you didn't include.
Ah, how did you select what you wanted to share?
Well, and that was an interesting observation, him saying that. And I think the reason why I probably remembered those incidents is because I would deem them more God incidents, where it was a real significant event or moment that mattered a lot in our journey. Because I'm thinking he was remembering things that I did not remember, or he was remembering things differently, which in a memoir is an intriguing, I don't know, just an intriguing situation. Because once I'd finished the book, I had a co-writer, so I obviously had help, and her job really was to pull the stories out of me and then make sense of them, organize them, put them in order. A lot of it was really my voice. It's just she was more editing, really, before it got to the editors. So the editors actually had a very boring job because she had done so well. I read it to David because I really, as my husband, partner in life, I wanted him to know, maybe if I had anything that he remembered was incorrect, to help me correct it. Yeah. Or if he thought it was insensitive, to pull it out, or if he had anything to add. And then I read it to him, and so we had that all down, and then I'm like, I got cold feet, and I'm like, I went to my co-writer and I said, I'm scared about this. Like, I'm telling the kids stories, and yet they don't have no clue what's in here.
it's very vulnerable, isn't it? It's very vulnerable.
Very vulnerable. And so I said to her, I said, are you sure that I shouldn't just have them okay, like their chapters especially? And she came back with an emphatic no. She said, it's your memoir. Everybody remembers things differently, with different highlights, with different,
right,
I don't know, bits of information. And she said, if you let them read it, it's going to confuse you, and then it's not going to be your memoir anymore.
Wow.
And I thought it was very wise words, because they would have. I mean, I hear back snippets. No one's really... I'm in a very funny scenario right now, I think, because when I first put it out, I wrote a foreword to each of the kids specifically, just, and I actually don't even remember what I wrote now, but it was personalized to each of them, because I'm representing part of their life. Mm-hmm. And I hand it to them, and then there's silence, really. I mean, nobody makes any comments. And I'm like, so what do you think of the book? And I'm getting back comments like, I just don't have the emotional energy even to open the pages.
Really?
And then I've got others who are like, and then I've got the comment from my son, who's the storyteller, to say, well, I'm intrigued about some of the stories you included and some you didn't. And then others were like, yeah, we're getting through it. And I'm like, oh, gosh. And then another one was like, well, I'm not 100% sure how I liked how I was portrayed. So it's sort of like, all right, well, we'll just leave it be. And frankly, I didn't have any huge expectations of how they were going to respond to it.
Yeah.
But now, last year, after the book was put out, we had a screenplay written of our story to be made for a movie. And our son, Joel, and the screenplay writer got together after it had sort of been scripted out. And they re-edited it and added and changed it and whatever, until they had got it to what they thought was really pretty good. And then I think about, they were set to film from mid from the beginning of October to the end of November. And they passed David and me, or they allowed, I should say, David and me to see the script probably at about the end of August. And, you know, everything's pretty set by then, you know, just to see what we thought. And obviously it's a dramatization of our life. So it's, there are going to be certain things where David and I look at one another and think, don't remember it like that, but, you know, but it is actually pretty accurate, to tell you the honest truth, but it still is a dramatization.
Sure.
And anyway, fast forward, they filmed it last year. It's in the editing process, probably the final editing process, putting it all together. David has seen the first half an hour a couple of times, but neither of us have seen the whole thing. And I'm feeling like my kids felt a year ago, where this has all taken place. The script has been written, really had not much input, just read it, made a couple of comments.
Right.
It's been filmed, now edited, so I don't even know what angles are being taken, how things, right. You know. Yeah, we were on the film set a few times, but film sets are so confusing because it's all over the place, like it's not chronological. And I'm feeling like, I don't know that I really want to see this. Like I really am feeling, I don't know how I'm going to react. I don't know. I feel totally out of my comfort zones. And now I get how the kids felt last year. This thing is actually in production and it's about them, but they have had no input and have no idea what it's lost, what's in there.
You know, this is absolutely fascinating to me though, but it makes me think of the Gospels, right? The Gospel writers.
Yeah.
And, you know, different perspectives on the same events. Why were some stories included here and some not here, depending upon the audience that the author was writing to and what their intent was for what they shared. There's so much nuance in the experience. I love that you got the ball rolling here and got your memoir out from your perspective. And maybe it'll be a process for all seven of the kids to just take that in little bites, to be able to see things through your eyes, because you were in a different role in the family than they were. You were wearing it differently. I marveled at how often you use the word adventure in your book. And you were up for it, weren't you? When you married David, you knew that it was going to be a bit of an adventure. Am I right? Because he was not necessarily a conventional kind of guy, and you weren't going for a conventional life.
No, I'm the youngest of four, but I have three older brothers, all who chose traditional careers. I mean, they went to university. One was a geologist who then became a civil engineer, another's a civil engineer, another's a teacher. I mean, they were work in the workforce doing conventional jobs, being employed. Then you've got my husband, who has not been to college, university, who's out just working and is an entrepreneur and is game, you know, finding money. He's always provided well, but money has not been a motivator. That's what I say. He says he doesn't care about money. That is not true, because somebody who doesn't care about money invariably ends up in financial, you know, problems, which we did do, but it wasn't because of his carelessness.
Right.
He was intentional. He had covered his bases. He had worked hard. Yeah, things just didn't go right. But not being motivated by money allows you to be an adventurer, because you know, you can get out there. You can, you know, because you're not always looking at the security of the bottom line. And I came from a pretty conservative family, and I've admired his entrepreneurial, I mean, in a crass sort of way, guts to just get out there and do it. And it is probably one of my challenges to us as Western Christians, is we are so intentional about being responsible, about doing the right thing, about providing well, that in a way the provision becomes a bit of a god, an idol, and we don't trust that God is our provider. And I think sometimes some of us are sitting back in careers that are making us good money, that are giving us health insurance, that are allowing us to buy our house. But in our hearts, God had maybe a different passion for us or a different plan. But we've chosen security. We've chosen to look like everybody else. And so even though I'm a conservative and grew up in a conservative home, I admire his spirit of adventure. I admire his ability to just take risk
and you
to follow God.
You tell your story of, your marriage, your early years, and his many attempts at building businesses and connections, and it was not always easy. But I mean, I was thinking, what would be a good subtitle for your book? Stand by your man. I mean, I was
actually that's a really good one. Thank you. I should have got you in on it earlier. We could have done a different subtitle.
No, your title is perfect. But I saw that thread running through, and I thought, what a lesson that is for all of us in our culture today. When you know we have cancel culture, somebody says something that we don't like, we write them off. You know, somebody does something that we don't like, you know, we're done. We walk away. Marriage is a commitment. And you and David were in it together through really difficult times when you weren't sure if you were going to have a roof over your head. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you tell, there's so many stories. I'm just so blown away by your faith, your resilience, and how you and David managed to always come back together as a united force in your family. Can you talk a little bit about that? And maybe like, what was one of the most challenging times that you knew you still had to stand by one another? How'd you do that?
Oh gosh. So many, pretty crazy deep. I met David when I was 16. We started dating when I was 17. I probably knew by the time I was close, about turning 19, that I loved this man. And he was talking marriage. Now, he's 5 years older than me. And he had had a lot of girlfriends. I hadn't had many boyfriends. You know, I'm still at school, you know, for most of this. And I had a very strong foundation of faith at that time. And I recognize that after your commitment to follow Jesus or follow the God in your life, like because that is a commitment, and sometimes we're following the wrong gods, but we all have that heart shape, that God shaped hole in us. We're all going to follow something. We're all going to make life choices to follow something. Yeah. After sort of, but you know, being a believer, it's to following Jesus. So after that commitment, I realized marriage is the most important commitment you are going to make. And so for me to move forward, I really had to know that God was in this, that if he wasn't in that foundation right from the beginning, if I believed and had confirmed that this was his plan, that this was his will for my life, then how do you have confidence? I mean, how do I know at 18, 19 what love even looks like? It feels good. I mean, but how do you know? How do you know who he's going to be in another 20 years, who you're going to be in? And you just don't know. So I spent some time before I could actually tell David I loved him or before I could start talking marriage. I spent some time praying and asking God, can you give me the affirmation that this is your will? I could say I love this man, but unless you're in this, unless this is your plan for my life, then frankly, I don't really want it, you know. And I felt over about a month period, I had three affirmations. I believe one came from the Bible. I'm not exactly sure what that looked like at that time, but I had two other guys who I really admired, who were walking, you know, were running Bible studies or in a church or whatever, that I'd admired spiritually, who both of them within a 2 week period came up to me and recognized the love that I had for David. They just sort of said, you really love this guy, or wow, I can see you marrying this guy, whatever. And I just thought, thank you, God. That is enough affirmation for me. I can move forward now with confidence. And for me, once I know God's in it, I mean, That's all that really matters, isn't it? Like, yeah. because you know he's going to, he has to fulfill his promises. He has to fulfill his promises that he will take care of us, that he will provide our needs, that he will look after us, that he is with us. Mm. And so I think that gave me that strong foundation to be able to move forward with confidence. And when the heart, and frankly, I did sit back and think, you know, you say those vows, and I believe it's a covenant marriage. We're making a covenant before God that I'm going to fulfill these vows, and those vows are hefty, you know, in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer. And so when I suppose I thought about all that before I said yes and before I actually made those vows. And so when the tough times came, it was a matter of saying, God, where are you? Show us what your hand is. Help us here and turn to him. And that was always probably my automatic response. And I think sometimes we can look at our partners as, oh, you know, like our spouses as it's your fault or you've made mistakes or you've done wrong. Yeah, we're all going to do wrong. We're all going to make mistakes.
Right.
But my hope wasn't in David to necessarily provide or to get us into tight situations and get us out. My hope that was God was in control. And I think changing that mental perspective allows you to go through anything.
Mm-hmm. That's huge. I mean, at one point you're describing you were newly arrived to America. You were pregnant. You had no car. You had no place to stay. You did get a place to stay with no furniture in it. You describe it in detail in the book. And I'm just, was there ever a part of you that was wishing that you had a more safe life?
I don't think so, to tell you the honest truth. I mean, seriously, the adventure thing is a thing for me. I like to be different. I've liked to be a little different since I was, a teen in high school. I could look at all these kids who are dating each other and I don't know, going to parties and stuff. And I'm like, you know, it's just not for me.
Yeah.
And I've been very happy to be countercultural in a lot of ways. Mm. And don't tell me where it comes from. I honestly don't know. I'd say it's just something that God gave me. So no, I never did really want a safe life. I mean, now we are fairly financially secure. I can give back to others as others had given to us when we needed it. And that is a huge privilege. And it's nice to be able to think, well, I don't have to look at the bottom line necessarily all the time anymore. I mean, that is a nice place to be, but I don't want to be relying on it either, because stuff happens. And so we are in a season where we can support other people who are doing it tough, and that's becomes then a privilege.
That's so beautiful, Helen. It's so interesting how you address the God of this age, the God of this culture, you know, being money, you know, being resources. You are definitely not driven that way. What would you say? I mean, obviously living for Christ, but is there another word or words that you would use that would describe what really motivates you and keeps you going?
Well, I think for a lot of us, as again, Western secure Christians, I think there's two thoughts that I have. I challenge Christians. Are you taking God on your journey, or are you following God on what he had plans for you? Mm. And that's a deep question.
Yes,
that's a deep question that is not going to be easily answered. And I have a feeling that a lot of us are so providing for ourselves and so secure and providing for ourselves that there is no room for God to actually show up, because we're not trusting him to show up. And so when we see the discrepancy between the God of the Bible and the God who we're experiencing in our lives, it's because we're not giving him room to actually provide for us, to care for. I mean, he cares for us. I'm not, but in a different way, you know. And so I see so many Christians around the world who are doing it tough, who are in countries where they're going to have to pay a price for following Jesus. I see the changes that are taking place in this country. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be too fat. I don't want to be too secure, because I want to keep looking to Him. Because at the end of the day, it's all about Him.
Mm-hmm. It grips me right now. It is so countercultural. Even in ministry, you know, even, you know, in ministry, my husband and I are both in ministry. My husband's a pastor. I am a radio host for a wonderful Christian station in Maryland, and this podcast. Ministry is our lives, right?
Yeah.
Yet we're right there battling that. How much, God, do we just hold out like this? Just let it go. Because when we get comfortable, it feels so good for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But we never want that to be the point, and we never want that to be the thing that we're going for. We want to see God show up and do what only He can do. It seems like you have miracle after miracle, but you left space. There was space for God to show up and to provide food on your table and, you know, furniture in your house. And it's amazing to me how much we can forget that once we get comfortable. Mm-hmm. Do you think that part of it is we're afraid that God now expects us to be more resourceful and responsible and not lean so heavy on Him? What is the error in our thinking that makes us kind of abandon that faith that says, God, you're my provider?
I think you're probably right. I think this culture does allow us to get very comfortable. And sometimes the things that make us comfortable are the things then that become so important in our lives. And we do lose perspective. And it's something I think we've got to continually fight against as best we can. I remember hearing a quote one time from, and I don't know the man, but the man who set up JCPenney. And apparently he lost, and I don't know which depression, it might have been the big one, he lost everything pretty much. And someone came to him, and he was a big philanthropist, and he said, they asked him the question, are you sorry that you gave so much money away because you've lost it now? And he said, I'm sorry, I didn't give more away.
Oh, I love that so much.
You know, and that's a that's a mentality. That's
right.
That's a mentality of, you know, I've seen the futility of money now. I just lost it all. Think what I could have done if I had given more away. And I admire that. I admire that thinking. It's probably not in my natural man to go that way, but David has taught me a lot about just not holding it, like just not keeping it too precious. And I've thought about it in the last couple of days. Actually, I was speaking to one of my daughter-in-laws about it, who is an accountant, and she said that our son has taught her a lot about just holding money a lot lighter, not being so consumed with planning and with, I don't know, making sure you've got enough. And that's what I've admired about David as well.
Mm. In this season of your life now, where there's a lot of success, right?
For the small bone. I'm actually more fearful of success than failure. And I actually am.
Unpack that for me.
I feel very vulnerable. Yes, we've obviously our eldest daughters, Rebecca St. James, she had a strong career for 20 years. We've got two sons who are in for King Country. They're riding the waves of success at the moment. I've felt for both Rebecca and for the boys a vulnerability of where is this taking you? And how are you going to keep your head together? We've got a lot of people who have gone before us. And I think for me, one of the powerful people who has gone before us is Billy Graham. Mm-hmm. That man was above repute. his whole life. Mm-hmm. You know, he had accountability. We are to finish strong. God wants us to finish strong.
Yes.
What does that look like when you have a public profile? Yeah. What does that look like when you're on a stage and people are applauding you and just want to touch you like you're somebody special, but you're not, you're just another person. Keeping your head together as a Christian in those environments that are unnatural, that should not be, you know?
Yes.
It's not an easy thing. And as a mum, I have felt very strongly the responsibility of being a Christian with a public profile, being a Christian who has a name, of being able to, as a single person under God, keep your head together where you're deflecting people's attention to Him, mm-hmm. where you're not sitting back thinking, well, look what I've done. These people are all here to see me. You know, to me, that success is more scary. And then for another, and this is, I've never shared this with anybody else, but you know, I'm presuming within this next month or so, David and I and the family are going to sit down and watch this movie that's about our family. I'm very aware that this movie, I'm feeling vulnerable. I've never shared it with anyone. This movie's about to come out. It's a movie about our family, our journey here to America. I know the family is under attack. I know the family is very under attack. So now I'm taking my vulnerabilities from one child, Rebecca, to two children, Joel and Luke, to a family. Mm. And I'm very aware the enemy comes to steal and to kill and to destroy. And so we are not a perfect family. Trust me. We have the people we like and the people that we're like, okay, yeah, well, we're in the family. and that's not, I mean, I'm saying from one to another. I mean, right, there are people right. like we're not a perfect family. We're just like any other family with our disagreements, with our hurts, with our vulnerabilities, you know. And I'm thinking, and now we're going to put all of us up for it, like to have this attention where people are going to think, where the enemy is going to want to have some field day to sort of destroy the perfect imaging that people might have about a family. Wow. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this is taking my, I'd prefer to stay in anonymity and just do my stuff to, you know, having one child, two children, and now a family. I'm like, oh gosh, oh gosh. So I suppose in recognizing that, and I know we can't live in fear, and I know that if God's going to open these doors, then He's going to go before us. Yes. But I'm going to be proactive as well. So my aim is over the next couple of months, that we are going to sit down as a family and we're just going to take, like, have a day, just the adults, the kids, their partners, spouses, where we come together as a unit and we just pray and talk and pray for each other. I want to pray for each other, the ones who might be doing it a bit tough at the moment, because there's always someone who's doing it tough. I want the others to have greater understanding. There's two, I think grace is, to give grace to another in relationships is so huge. It's such a God-given gift that we can do, that we can trust that the way that God sees somebody, we can take a bit of that as well. But the second thing is love covers a multitude of sin. Yes. And if we can choose to love one another as a family, if we can go before and sort of clean the slate just a little and pray for one another.
Yeah.
I feel like if we did that maybe once soon, maybe another time towards the end of the year, maybe another time at the beginning of next year, that we'll be able to clear the air of, I don't know, not disagreement, but just relational stress that could be between anyone or another in the family. And in so doing, create hopefully greater unity. We have the love. I know that. It's just that life happens. We're people. We're going to irritate one another.
It's what we do. Sorry. And families, we're hardest on each other in families. And I loved what you said about, you know, having grace for the people in our families. We could be harder on the people in our families than people that we don't even know. And that hurts my heart. What an amazing, wise woman you are. I feel so honored to have been able to spend some time with you today. I feel like the Lord has used you so specifically. It's just, His timing is amazing. And I'm just so grateful because so many things you said have just kind of cut through some clutter in my own life. And that's what the Holy Spirit does. He cuts through the clutter. Thank you for risking a great life of faith and following Jesus. And thank you for even risking sharing your story. And Helen, I will be praying for you in this vulnerable.
Well, thank you. And you know what it's like as a mom. You want the best. And honestly, I just don't want, I want to finish strong. I want to run this race to the best of our abilities and to finish strong. And I want it for each of our kids. We keep praying. David and I pray together, have done for the last couple of years, every night, because as we recognize now, we have no parents. Our parents have all passed on now. We are the matriarch and the patriarch of this little brood. And I want to give to them what was given to us, and that is prayer. And I know that prayer is powerful. And so I appreciate this time that we've been able to spend together. I appreciate when God brings us to mind, you praying for this mama's heart. And that as we move forward, that we will not go forward with our eyes closed, but go forward just trusting that God will go on this journey with us, whatever that might entail.
Amen. Amen. And that he would literally seal your family. Your family would be so powerful in prayer that you would deflect whatever fiery darts come at you, that it wouldn't break the integrity of what God has built there. I will be praying for you. Thank you. And I can't wait to see you in person when you come to Maryland.
I'll look forward to it. I'll have a face there that'll be like, oh yes, there she is.
Oh my gosh, you see what I mean? I just feel like I benefited so much from just having a conversation with this amazing lady, Helen Smallbone. So much wisdom. Her book is called Behind the Lights, The Extraordinary Adventure of a Mum and Her Family. And of course, she's going to be coming locally here to our Eastern Shore for our Bright FM Women's Conference. And you can get all of the details at brightfm.com. But in the meantime, I just want you to check out her book. You can listen to it on audio as well. And maybe go through this podcast again. I needed to take notes on this one because there was so much wisdom that was shared. And I've got a list of people that I want to send it to. I hope that you will share the podcast with people that could be encouraged by it. And you know what? If you're enjoying Your Day Brighter, leave a review because that helps other people to find it. Thank you so much for being a part of our Your Day Brighter listening community. I want to give some special thanks and shout outs to our awesome team, Todd Gaddy, Caroline Burke, Aaron Branham, and Jared Akehurst. You guys are the best. Your Day Brighter is produced by me, Tracy Tiernan, for Brighter Media Group. Our executive producer is John Lawhon. And you know what we like to say around here? We've got a little motto, okay? Tell somebody your story today. Or better yet, ask to hear theirs. Thanks for listening.